Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2008 Home Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
What we really look for in our real math is truth. Because the questions that we ask in math are really in seeking truth. We like to say in our math classes, "Eureka, I have found it," meaning I have found the truth. The truth is so essential in our search, but what does it really take to find the truth? Wonder. That sense of wonder and curiosity is essential. We also bring to our classes an opportunity to ask questions, to find the right questions to ask, to ponder. And to bring all of these things together in what I consider about the most essential piece, which is to work. Now in D&C 9, 7 through 9, the Lord said, "You have supposed that I would give it unto you when you took no thought save it was to ask. Behold, you must study it out in your mind." And what we take from this is that we must work. There's a lot of effort that goes into acquiring whatever it is we're seeking. When we seek for truth and we're using mathematics as a tool, it's very essential that we put in that time. Spencer W. Kimball says that experience is the best teacher. But only fools live by it. Because we are truly fools if we do not learn from the experience of others and bring that all together in our work. So as we talk about these, you know, the pressure and the stress that is actually required to transform us into the mathematicians and the people that we want to be. I have here the website listed, all of these papers. I have a 40-page paper on this topic, the slides. All the information is free at eurekastudies.org. I'll leave that and go on to let you know there. It's really beautiful in our mathematics how we bring together our faith and our facts with the tools that mathematics give us. We can ask the questions that are really important to us, and we can find answers. How can we become better stewards of this planet? Really compelling questions like, how can we feed his sheep, both physically and spiritually? How can we work with the resources that we have, perhaps with the nematodes, with the bacteria, with all of the organisms that are around us that are part of God's plan? How can we work with them to benefit ourselves and to provide resources for others? These are the compelling questions that mathematics really brings us to answer. And this is what makes math real. Now, as I've studied the situation where math is in our country, I come up with a basic roadmap for educators. And it's very simple. Whether you're involved in TJ Ed, whether you're involved in basic homeschooling, whether you have a mixture of public and private schooling or public and homeschooling, whatever your situation is, basically comes down to the same conclusion, which is we all need to increase our arithmetic exposure. We need to increase the use of story problems, real things that connect to our lives. We need to increase the historical connections that we offer when we study math. We need to also increase our literary connections that deal with mathematics and also increase our conversational math. What this means is that we're going to be working a lot harder. The beauty of it is that our technology actually makes it easier and faster for us to learn. The only thing you have to be concerned about is that that technology offers immense distractions. Most of my presentation today is directed more towards our scholar age students. I tend to get, you know, my Eureka Math students at age 10 or 12. You know, and the oldest students are about 17. So I'm directing it towards that group, and they are particularly prone to being distracted by these by technology. So we want to keep that in mind as we think about our ability to improve our mathematics. Now, a word that you may have heard that was coined in the late 80s is innumeracy. And innumeracy is very similar to the word illiteracy. Illiteracy means that though you may be able to read and write, you can struggle to read and write, you can't read and write well enough to make decisions in society. That somehow you're a little handicapped because your ability to read and write is hampered. Now, innumeracy is the same for our number system. You may be able to actually do the computations. You have completed series of math, but perhaps your ability to deal with numbers, to analyze numbers, to really use numbers in your life is hampered, and we call that innumeracy. Can you really understand chance and risk and yield well enough to make decisions that benefit yourself and others? It's pretty clear that our country is having a bit of a mathematical crisis. I have had some very good friends from China, one who's a math teacher from China. And so I began to look at China, and I'll be referring some to the Asian mathematics model because it offers some great pointers for us as we look at TJ Ed, and we have some already built-in benefits because you are a homeschooler. So we'll talk about those a bit. But to set the stage, Annie Han, who has a PhD in mathematics from China, she says that it's no secret that Asian students perform at a higher level in mathematics. The mathematics performance of students in the United States is in decline, and we are facing a crisis. We have some specific challenges with TJ Ed, and as I've had students come through my classroom, we've been able to make a few alterations that help us, because the principles that are so valuable in TJ Ed, the principles that free us from that conveyor belt system, can also become a crutch if we're not very, very careful. So when you see that happen in your home, or even before, I suggest making a very simple change of conjunctions. And we've had Oliver DeMille look at some of these, and he says, definitely inspire. But when you need to, change that word, inspire and require. Require your students to work. Require your students to produce. Change you, not them, to you and them. Yes, you must find a way to become educated, to gain a little bit of that scholarly attitude. But definitely, as your students are scholar age, it has to be them. Oliver DeMille has told us many times, do not ignore your children's education. For math and science, we use classics, and they are fabulous. They bring so much life to our study. But we say instead of classics, not textbooks, we say classics and textbooks, because textbooks offer us an organizational system. In addition to the classics, we also use original documents, which I consider classic works. So all of the studies, if you have someone who has access to all of the database studies, that's a great way to bring original documents in for your students and to update your math and science programs. We also say mentors and professors. Some of the best mentors in this world are also going to be professors. Simplicity then, complexity, and quality and quantity. For indeed, there will be no quality without a lot of quantity. Our estimations at what it would take to bring your student to a scholarly level in math and science using only original documents is over 10 million pages of original documents. We try to quantify it, but it's well over 10 million pages, and we just use original documents. We use these things, but we also use some textbook information to organize and separate it. I consider my program for math and science a supplemental program, meaning it's going to give you all the stimulus that you need. It'll give purpose to where you're going in math and science. It will connect math and science to life. It will not do that in and of itself, offer all of your basic skills. And so I say it's supplemental. Add it to whatever you're doing to improve your students' basic skill level. I like to look at Jaime Escalante, who was featured in the film Stand and Deliver. And one of the things that frequently happens with our society is we maybe exaggerate some of the improvements, or in this case, Hollywood only had 102 minutes to tell the whole story. And so it appears in the movie that he was able to take substandard, lazy students into calculus within 1 or 2 years. That is not the case. If you go and read his actual works, it was 5 years that he spent working with these students before he had students enter calculus. But some of these little points are important for us to note as we maybe gauge our own students' progress. It takes time. It takes lots of repetition. And it takes sacrifice. The students that succeeded gave up summers. 5 years they studied in order to improve. Now, one of the things that we do in my math program is that we study great theories before students are fully capable. You know, I go ahead and offer many college level math theory little sessions, and it brings a lot of great stimulation to our classes. But we also want to caution parents as they begin this that there's a little bit of a risk. The United States kind of experimented with this in a program you may have heard of called New Math. It started in the 60s, and that's where they introduced advanced theories to students who didn't have basic skills. It tends to result in students with a very poor skill level who never achieve numeracy in mathematics and science. I prefer to get my students into algebra by 12 years old, just as a little bit of a gauge. I've looked at the LDS position. Elder Dallin H. Oaks in a fireside said, "It is not that the church is for or against homeschooling. The church is for education. And whatever path best meets that end is the path to support." So as we make these decisions, it's just important to remember we're really for education, whatever that takes. One of the most inspiring moments of my life was when I took the time to memorize The Family, A Proclamation to the World. And as you know with memorization, when it takes a lot and lot of repetition, so those words are just pouring over you constantly. And as those words kind of bathed my mind, I thought, wow, you know, the responsibilities of parents, primarily fathers, are to provide for the necessities of life and protection for their families. And that is an extremely daunting task. And I was very concerned to be certain that the students that were passing through my classroom were aware that they would be expected to provide, perhaps in a market that is more and more difficult to provide for your family in. And so I feel a great responsibility to prepare them adequately. And I want to pass that on to you. You may not have any of the problems that we have seen in some of the students. I hope you don't. But since we consider, you know, we don't want to wait and let experience be the best teacher, I'm going to just share with you some of the concerns that I've had. In addition, President James E. Faust said, "Young men of the Aaronic priesthood should strive very diligently to acquire a skill and as much education as possible." As a teacher, I want to give them the sense of awe. I want to bring the wonder and the curiosity into the classroom. I want to show them how math and science is all about seeking truth. You know, when you take a small child and see a flower, it's not a new flower to you. Why is it exciting as a parent? Why do you bring that? Because the child is experiencing it. You show them, you relive that experience. And as a teacher, we constantly relive the wonder and the awe that we bring into our math and science classes. And that's really one of the great goals of our class. We talk a lot in our class about how math is power. And you'll hear this throughout the presentations that I'm offering the next couple days. Math is power. Math will give you an opportunity to go somewhere. Now, in the first semester of my classes, we really broaden the term of mathematics. We go beyond the boring mathematics situations. We make sure that we don't have any repetition without relief, that we really get away from any drilling without purpose, and that we completely divorce ourselves of mindless activities. I want you to think about your students and consider how they would feel, perhaps if you brought them into a situation where you asked your students to get on a really bulky suit and go in to walk across a gym floor and use a long pair of tongs and put a washer on an exposed screw with those tongs and then put a nut on that and tighten it down. Imagine the response that your students might have if you ask them to repeat the task maybe 200 times. And the last 20 times had to be perfect or they just weren't able to move on. Now, I suspect that your students would be like mine, and they wouldn't do it, and they would complain that it would be terribly boring. But I want you to imagine the same situation if you let the students know that your group or your family, your little home school, had been chosen to go and make a repair to the space station, that you were going to be one of the ones who would be selected, and that this was an essential piece of that experience. The students had to have to practice this very boring task. Only the students who really master it will be considered for a trip. Now, how are your students going to feel about doing this boring task? As teachers, we're exactly in that situation. We're trying to show our students where we're going. We're trying to take the boring task and show them what doors it will open for them. We talk about these kind of situations. We use simulations where we pretend that we're going through certain activities. We also use a bit of competition because it motivates students. We definitely use dual curriculums where we don't just stick with perhaps Saxon math, something like that. We use the Eureka program, we use the Saxon program, perhaps we use the new math in the Singapore series. We also get students to sign a contract. And you can invent all kinds of wonderful things for the contract. Frequently, things that we use in our home are, you know, we will plan this fun activity when certain things are done. We'll begin planning it. Even your birthday party. We can have a math party if you're not completed, you know, if you haven't completed what you have set out to do. Or we can go and do something else. Your reward will depend on what you have done. Now, my math students, we go to a lot of different activities during the year, and then we also culminate with a great, you know, virtually the whole week at Zion National Park. And the math we do there is all about how far can you climb, you know, basically how much fun can you have, the physics of being up in this beautiful country. So there are rewards. We set these rewards out because students achieve things when they have a deadline like that to reach for. Now, when we broaden the vision of mathematics, we end up reading a lot of books. We read poetry, we write poetry, we watch movies, we play games. It doesn't look like your typical math class. But remember, this is our stimulus math class. We do it once or twice a week. And the students do, you know, some kind of basic skill math on their own. Some of the things that we watch out for, some of the traps, are that when you're in this broadening state of mathematics, that it is a transitional state, that you do continue to move through these ideas into very deep study. In fact, the students that move successfully through my courses are ready for college-level math and science classes. So, you know, that would be a goal, that they're producing significant work. It's a little bit risky if you do only one semester. My first semester is called Truth. If you do only one semester, you might get the idea, as some students have said, that if I'm practicing my violin, I'm doing math, and that's good enough. Because math and music are, you know, so similar. And I just want to point that out as a little trap. We want to move through that and get to the deeper study. The literary resources that are available to math and science teachers are phenomenal. They were not available a few years ago. There are some that were even printed in the 60s, but we have now available to us. There's one that we'll be discussing, Arithmetic for Billy Goats. It's out of print. I have the rights to use it for education, which is shared with you on the free site. You can just download the whole book. Here we have Pictured String, Straight Edge, and Shadow, another fun book that brings history and purpose into math. This, I have a very long literary resource list. It's very shortened here into three little groupings. This one has a lot of the biology and the quantum mechanics resources. This book, The Chemist Who Lost His Head, wow, it was probably 15 or more years ago that I read that with my children. It inspired us. I had read all about the laws that Antoine Lavoisier had developed in college courses I had never knew about his life. It really makes a difference to learn about these people. Okay, we have a modern quadrivium model that's a little different. How many of you are familiar with the trivium and the quadrivium? Just by raise of hands. Okay, the trivium, we're talking about our reading and our writing, our grammar, logic, rhetoric. You may be very familiar with that. Well, the ancient quadrivium brought together in this mathematical model, arithmetic, astronomy, geometry, and music. And you will run into this model in your TJ Ed studies. I'm not going to go into it, but I'm going to show you the one that we've come up with in our class. We call it our modern quadrivium model. And it's a little different because it shows the overlap. But it's extremely helpful. When we get into math theory, you'll see how this just clears things up for students. That we have three circles coming together in the Venn model. The three circles are labeled time, space, and number. And it is number that is the pure study. That is arithmetic. It's what we usually think of when we think of math. But when number comes in contact with the space, that's geometry. When number comes in contact with time, that's generally what we term music, where number and time are coming together in a rhythm. Also, where time and space come together, that's history, and we involve that in our study of mathematics because it brings so much richness and understanding to mathematics. We also see where time and space and number all come together, and that's science. And of course, my great love is science because I believe that mathematics is made practical and real and fun through science. It answers the real questions. And mathematics is a part of science in the TJ Ed, and I love that. Well, here we have a clip of the Billy Goats story. And as I mentioned, you'll all be able to get that copied for free. The Billy Goats book is a little bit like a comic book. There are pictures on every page. It's a little bit silly. It's even a little bit rude, which kids like a little bit. There are these two billy goats that fight. And, you know, I love classic literature, and so I wasn't okay with that until I started coming in contact with all of these youth, and they love it. They absolutely love it that the book is just a little bit rude. So, and nothing profane. Don't worry about that. It's just not as nice. So the billy goats come together, and they're in this deep conflict over food. And what's their food? They love corn cobs. So there's this big pile of corn cobs, and they're fighting over them. But there's this very young billy goat that is skinny, and he's the cerebral one. But he's juxtaposed against his Uncle Max, who is the bully. He's the big guy. And they have no number system, and they're trying to sort out their corn cobs. They invent a number system, and that's the beauty of this book. As you read aloud to your children, there are all different levels that they can receive this book. When I read it aloud, my very young children love it. The older children love it, too. We're also bringing in logic versus nonsense, which you'll see in many of the books listed on my reading list. If you love the McBroom series, you'll see so many mathematical logic puzzles in those books. We just absolutely adore them. Of course, Lewis Carroll, the king of nonsense, lots of mathematical riddles in those books. So we see that. We see a one-to-one ratio. There's also a little play with economics. You see these goats working for personal gain, and they introduce the binary system. Because when the goats invent their system, they don't have the 10 fingers. They've got the 2 hooves. So they Their system is a binary system, which offers a little bit more interest for older students as well. We talk about all kinds of fun things with the Billy Goats. You learn to state the obvious. It's an important piece of math and science. You state the obvious. You come down to the very simplest points. And on a religious note, the older I get, the fewer very simple truths I hang on to. It is those things that are very most obvious and simple that I hold to. We use repetition in this book, and it's another great tool. We learn from reading this book that we're all mathematical, that we all have this sense of math. And as we'll do today with the youth, we're going to, you know, we take one student who says, I'm just not mathematical. I would just live without math. I would love it. And we put them on a theoretical island, and we get them to talk about what they would do on this island until they see that they would build a number system. They would build a number system to find out what time they had to get back to their rude little shelter, when they should expect a storm, when to pick their fruit, how to build a ladder to get to, you know, different parts. They would build a system. And the more intricate your truth, the more essential your system. So that's a beautiful part where students say, hey, I'm mathematical. I am a mathematician. We also see that the old systems are very, very valuable and familiar. That's a fun part of Billy Goats. Now, as we look at some of the most difficult mathematical theories, students actually love to get into some of these fun math theories. We look at a couple of statements, and we try to figure out which one is the most true. And if I could just get someone who would like to be a very tortured volunteer, someone who would rather have attention than respect. If they would like to look at these statements and try to pick out which one would you think is the most true. Let's see, we've got sugar is harmful to health, 1 + 1 = 2. All birds fly, human beings are classified as hominins, 115 × 37 = 3,255, or ferritin combined with iron is called apoferritin. Anyone want to be that tortured volunteer?
1 + 1 = 2.
Okay, very nice. 1 + 1 = 2. That's basically what our students pick out. Does anyone want to dissent? Yes.
The fourth one, human beings.
1, 2. Human beings, very nice. Okay. And you do not think that 1 + 1 = 2? Okay, and why? Very nice. Okay. Because 1 does not equal 1. Because that has never been proven in math theory. When you get into math theory, you always, when you start a proof, you say, let 1 equal 1. We're going to make an assumption that 1 equals 1. Once we make that assumption that 1 equals 1, then we can say that 1 + 1 = 2. And generally, students would not get this kind of math theory fun until they reach college, you know, even maybe the greatest liberal arts colleges or math degree. So that's kind of a fun thing that we do. And then we try to figure out, why does 1 not equal 1? And we use our Venn model. We have to assume that 1 equals 1, but that's actually not true. Think about the corn cobs. The Billy Goats were lining up corn cobs in a 1-to-1 ratio. What happened? Are all the corn cobs going to be the same? Why would some corn cobs be different? Well, they're going to be different sizes, different moisture levels. Some might be moldy or rotten. You know, they're not all the same. If you weighed them, measured them, they're all going to be different. There's a difference in the corn cobs. How about apples? Of course, we have many varieties of apples. You know, apples are going to have different vitamin C content, different carbohydrate content. Again, the quality. Some of them might be good. Some of them might not be good. But then the students tend to bring up to me in these discussions, well, man-made things, machine-made things, now those have got to be the same, right? They're all identical, stamped-out items. So one of the things we looked at was coins. and we look at our model. Maybe I'll flip back here and let you look back at that Venn model. And as we look at the coins, we think about, now we have one quarter in my pocket, and we have another quarter. And I just drive straight out here out of Virginia Beach, 1 hour, in a motorboat, and I throw the other quarter into the ocean. Now, are they equal? Is their value the same? One's not accessible, right? And so we had the students work out how much would it cost to get that quarterback. They had to work out, you know, scuba lessons, scuba gear, metal detectors, global positioning, you know, gear to figure out how to get that quarterback. But those quarters are not the same because you can see they're in different places in space. In real life, there's a qualitative and a quantitative value for everything. And so we talk about that. So how about one quarter in my pocket, one quarter in Abraham Lincoln's pocket? Are they the same value? They're in different times, and therefore the value is different. And we use this model to kind of conquer some of those really fun elite mathematical theories. That becomes very fun. Now let's look at that as we talk about now we spend weeks on each of these principles, so we're rushing through to give you a little taste. We're going to analyze the odds of two armies, Army M and Army G. These are ancient armies. Army M has 120,000 trained soldiers. Army G has 50,000. And, well, someone make an estimate. Who do you think is going to win? What? It looks like 120,000 has the benefit. So we're going to say, you know, just looking at that, Army M is probably going to win. Now let's look a little more of the reality of Army G. There are 50,000 volunteers, and they put out the call to come to battle, but only 32,000 actually show up. Once they get there, the leader stands up and says, you know, everybody who's scared, just go on home. Well, 22,000 leave. Of those remaining 10,000, the leader says, just go get a drink at this river. And when they go to drink, most of them use their hands to pick up the water and drink the water. And yet the leader says, only those who lay down and lap up the water like a dog, only you are going to stay and fight. And that left him with 300 soldiers. So now we look, we have 300 against 120,000. In addition, Army G has no weapons. Instead, they're given trumpets, clay pitchers, and a lantern. Of course, you recognize the story by now. This is the story found in Judges chapter 7, where Gideon takes his army against the Midianites. And of course, he wins. Those soldiers, they break their clay pots, the lanterns show up, they blow their horns, they descend upon the army of Midian, and the army is frightened, they kill each other, the rest run off. This is real life. There is a qualitative and a quantitative value for every single situation. Pure number is only theory, and that's why in our Venn model you'll see it separated. It's pure number is arithmetic. We have to make that assumption that one equals one. In our story, one soldier does not equal one soldier. A qualitative assessment brings time and space into the picture. Now, science involves aspects of qualitative and quantitative, and it's really fun. But religion, that brings in a whole new aspect of a qualitative nature. As the Israelites learned, when the Lord was fighting with them, the quality of their situation changed completely. As I've mentioned, I love great literature. And so Pearl S. Buck wrote in one of her books, she's kind of speaking in this character's words in The Goddess Abides. The character says, "No one really understood music unless he was a scientist," her father had declared. And not just a scientist either. Oh no, only the real ones. The theoreticians whose language is mathematics. She had not understood mathematics until he'd explained to her that it was the symbolic language of relationships. And relationships, he had told her, contained the essential meaning of life. Well, it's these relationships that really catch our attention as educators. And I have looked extensively at this Asian education. My friend that was here from China, she was just grueling over the fact that she had left all of these students. And when I realized she had left 60 students, she starts with them when they enter school. I believe it's age 4 there. She travels their entire education. She is their math teacher for 2 decades. She becomes their tutor usually in college. In China, we learn through studies that teachers rely on real-life connections. They use student discovery, student interest, and relationships. In contrast, our American teachers cite that they feel the most important things in their classroom are concrete representations and appealing to learning styles. Now, in your homeschool groups, you've got this great benefit because you've got the relationship. Whether you're just doing it at home by yourself or whether you're forming one of these little co-ops, it's a great thing to find this. The ideal teacher is really being the collaborator and the guider. Move through some of these. It's great that, you know, knowledge is owned exclusively. In DNC 130.18 tells us that whatever principle of intelligence we attain unto in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection. When your students start to grasp that this is the real stuff, you know, they may be wanting the stuff of the world, which is so tempting to teenagers. But the stuff of knowledge, that's what you can really take with you. And though our societal information just continues to accumulate, each of us starts at zero. You know, we can say we went to the moon and we understand atomic theory, meaning we as Americans, we've achieved that. But we personally have to understand each of these things because there is no conduit between the brains. There's no way to just upload information from you as a teacher to your student. They have to experience it. You can stand up there and wave your arms, but the only real good is if you can get them to do it. So in our homeschool relationships, we really look for a situation where a teacher ideally would just love the subject. Probably all of you love math, right? You're here because you decided to homeschool because math is your favorite subject. Well, if math is not your greatest love, and I would have to say the kind of math that's my love is science, but then perhaps you could just appreciate the subject. You could appreciate where it takes you. And you can respect which doors are going to be open for you because of math. And you may need to seek some kind of a cooperative teacher, a tutor, even some situations, you know, they have joint public school teachers or something that you can use. I just feel so essential that we get some subject mastery to sharpen our skills. You know, I used to teach swimming lessons in Houston for many, many years. And that first day of class, when all the little three-year-olds would come for their beginning lesson, I knew exactly which parents were swimmers. The non-swimming parents brought children in. They were just clinging to their leg. You know, they were just hanging on to them. And they were just terrified of the water. And they would say, I'm afraid of the deep. I'm afraid of the deep. Well, the whole pool is deep to a three-year-old. The same principles that help you to swim in shallow water work in deep water. It is essential that students and educators carry this kind of concept into their math and science fields. The impact of the relationship that you have on your students is unmatched. If you are not a great lover of math and science, find a way to become some kind of a great advocate in math and science. It is the relationships between the students and the teachers that becomes most essential, and it is that willingness to work that makes the difference for students. If you bring enthusiasm into your classes, If you relate to life, if you bring science as application, that's where you're going to see the true benefits. Now, before we go to the question and answer period, I'd like to share with you just a little bit of the way that we bring student interest into our courses. I generally teach in about a two-hour block. And of that two-hour block, the first 30 minutes we call the student window. The students elect their own leadership. All of this is found on the website under course resources. There's material written about how we do it. You don't have to do it that way. You know, it's just the way that we've done it. But we elect a leadership. That leadership runs that student window. They prearrange for a devotional. We have people come in and talk about how they see themselves as mathematicians, the ahas that they have had over the week, or however long it has been. We pretty much try to keep that time at 30 minutes. I have never had a class that had a problem with that. Frequently, they'll turn the time over to me before that 30 minutes ends. But we also have gathering games, which we'll do a few with our youth today. You know, we have some of that time to play games, to discuss what they're doing in life, and it's so valuable for me. I sit there and listen to what their interests are. And I can direct my lectures to what interests them in life. Now, I am not at the mercy of every student whim. I don't change my path completely, but I bring in the students just with little comments about what they do and where they're going. Because, as you know, with mentors, the mentor says to the student, come along with me on my path until you're ready for yours. As students experience some of these little issues, it's really vast in scope what we see. We see, you know, a student come in and do a Bach cello solo and then have the students discuss some of the math involved. We've had students really criticize advertisements and talk about the fallacies in logic and basically the terrible math involved in some of these studies. The water quality issue has been huge in our area. Students have gotten involved in that. We also had a great little demonstration about bioaccumulation. You know, students do all kinds of things. Pictured here is one of our favorites. We do lots of acid-base experiments and try to start to, you know, have students really get a handle on some of these. Now, I'm sure we'll get this in the questions, so I put a page of resources in math. And a lot of these are some of my very favorite resources. Let's see. Pardon me. Okay, I just put one page of them here. I've kind of drilled down to the very simplest. But Mequon math, how many of you are familiar with Mequon? Very nice. It's very creative math. It's just for very young children. Also for very young children, it's also written in the paper that would be posted up. The best things I ever did was get a very long, tight string and stretch it across a piece of my schoolroom. And on that string, I put beads. I put 5 to a color, and I had 60 beads. And I just had, my oldest son was 5 at the time. And he would count the beads, and he would work with the beads, and we would play with the beads, and they would be trains and cars and all different things. And pretty soon, he was able to manipulate numbers. And without me ever doing anything but playing with him and that bead string, you know, he would say, 12 fives are 60. You know, and he's in kindergarten. And he would begin to multiply. And he could begin to see things. It was just a very simple manipulative, and there are lots out there. But it was a fun one for our family. Kids are kind of drawn to this long, tight thing. You can zip those beads up and down that string. It was simple. It was fun. It worked when they were young. We have also used, of course, Saxon math. I really like the Singapore math. Now, I can sit down and take some of those Singapore math tests that are written for the high schoolers, and I sweat. Okay, these are different than your regular math courses. They make you work in a different way. And that's why I say when you use some kind of dual curriculum, you're going to see improvement in your students. It makes you work. This one really makes you put out that time. Some of these I've only seen used in the students that I've tutored. So they've used living math and Matthew C. Calculus Without Tears, fun. That's available online. Calculus Without Tears, I believe, is a no-charge program. It was when we downloaded it. Thinkingblocks.com is actually made for the Singapore Math. Any of you heard of any of these? These pretty familiar? Okay. We also play the game Set. How many of you love Set? Okay, very nice. Equate. Are you familiar with Equate? Kent, would you grab that out of the bag and just at least hold it up? Equate is like Scrabble with math equations. Yes, and students, you know, you can play this with a very simple math equation, but you get points when you're using powers and fractions. You know, you really get the points. And, of course, we play a lot of chess. We've had to hide our chessboard occasionally so kids would do something else. And so we've had fun. We also use a lot of, are you familiar with Science Friday? Okay, great. Those are great ways for you to hear current math issues. And one of the things I love about those programs is they tend to give you both sides. Either give them in one week or another week, or they give you two different experts with different ideas. And so kids are on that edge of we don't know everything. When math and science are taught as if it's already all done, it is the most boring, drudgery, awful thing that you can imagine. And that's basically what you get in most texts. And that's why texts don't work by themselves. Let's see. I think the others are fairly self-explanatory. I'm good to move into the question-answer session. I'll go ahead and take questions. Anybody? You guys have got it all figured out. That is great. Oh, okay. Yes, ask.
I struggle with my toddlers because I love, even though I sounded dumb when I gave that answer, I love math and science. And so, but with my older ones, I want to be with them, and my toddlers just go...
Okay, so doing the
walls, and so I struggle with that conflict.
And how old is your oldest?
He's 10, so he's not quite even 12, but just
great.
It's just a struggle.
Now, you're at a great time though, because when they're 10, typically they still want to be home, they want to be with you, you know, and so you get as much of that math and science in when they're doing that.
How do you focus when the toddlers are?
Yeah.
It's just hard.
Right.
I mean,
right. It is really hard. I don't know that I have any great answers for you on that one, except, you know, they play with Play-Doh or they're measuring wheat. I frequently will have my kids, because we eat strange as well. I'm into nutrition and have been for many decades. So, you know, I have them scoop wheat and, you know, they can identify 12 or 15 grains in beans. Where a lot of kids would not normally be able to do that. But put them to work. Make them clean your walls. And literally, my four-year-old loves to wash walls and baseboards, and she feels fulfilled. Now, when I teach students, I always offer some of these. You know, we do a little bit of biochemistry and a little bit of organic chemistry when we get into nutrition. They feel fulfilled when you give them something hard. And think of that in the same way for your very young children. Say, wow, you know, I'm going to be working with the 10-year-old. I usually tell my 4-year-old, it's just too hard. I don't think that you'll be able to wash the walls. So let me just set this bucket here, and we'll let your older sister do it. She'll go and do it, you know, and she'll have a great time doing it, and she'll feel so fulfilled. So I try to give kids things that are always a little bit too hard and give them that kind of stimulation that, you know, they would adore. Yes?
Math, I have a problem where, like, I tried Miquan math, it was okay. I just keep switching around, and my kids are young, and I have problems with figuring out how to cook it all with TJ Ed, which is, I liked your combinations, but do you recommend you start with one and stick with it all the way, or how would you recommend just going?
Miquan is so simple,
yeah.
and it's so limited.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Oh, yes, let me repeat the question. Thank you. Okay, she said, How do you handle the curriculums? What do you start with, and how would you continue to go through? Well, Miquan is a very simple program, 8 workbooks, something like that. It's simple enough that I would go ahead and stick with it personally. I love the creativity in Miquan. The very simple pages and workbooks, it's not a lot of color, but it's good, simple math. You know, the equations are inverted many times. They make students come up with equations as well, so they're doing a little bit of invention. And then integrate the play. If your children are young enough to enjoy something like the math string or get involved in some of the science that makes math fun, I would recommend that. Yes?
When you listed the principles, was that pretty much for scholar phase or for all phases?
Well, that is primarily for scholar phase, but it is very easy to convert some of these phases early, especially when your children are ready. You know, definitely, I think it's very easy to say, yes, inspire and require on all levels. Require them to produce something, because students, you know, could get distracted by things that are not where you want them to go. Yes?
I find myself getting very frustrated with my 10-year-old because she does her math and she, for the most part, knows how to do it. She'll make stupid mistakes like 8 times 4 is 24. You know, and it ruins the whole thing. And then she feels stupid because she missed it, but it was a simple mistake. So how do you teach them and expect a lot out of them without getting frustrated when they fall short of what they need?
We use, our first semester here is called Truth. The second semester we call Methods. Basically some of the methods that we use to succeed in math and science. And in that Methods we integrate something we call Speed Drills. And the students just, it's usually a little bit simpler than they can handle. But it's the Speed Drills. And you might liken it to the Apollo 13. You can watch that for one of your family night movies or something. You know, when they are so good that they can do their math and science under stress, which those scientists were having to do vector calculations to make sure they were going to even hit the Earth, when they didn't have enough oxygen, they're freezing cold. You know, basically you're providing a little bit of stress. You'll see those basic skills improve. And you want to shoot for 100%. You do the speed drills until they're 100%. And it's easy to make the papers. You can even let your students make their own papers. The homeschoolmath.net has a little worksheet maker that's very handy. It doesn't work as well in the subtractions, but everything else it works great. Sometimes it makes the subtractions end up with negatives. Yes?
I was just wondering, how did you feel about teaching algebra or geometry first? Which do you recommend?
Well, Saxon actually teaches them together. Okay. So you get them at the same time. And we've typically done that. Singapore Math also integrates algebra and geometry. Okay, yes, that's great. If you're using both, you won't see the title geometry, but it's in the texts. So if you're doing those, you're going to get a very good handle on both situations.
For core phasers, besides the math string, is there anything else that you can suggest?
Yes, in fact, I have a bunch in the paper. This is a 40-page paper called Transcending Arithmetic into the... Yes. Transcending Arithmetic into the Wild Expanse of Mathematics. We will be uploading the new versions of some of these this weekend. So, but we go through a lot of the toddler issues. You know, basically, gosh. You know, we talk about just some of the... Science is probably the biggest thing that I have used. Integrating science, allowing them to use their math and science as we go ahead in those experiments. Questions? Comments? Yes?
Do you have recommendations for the more difficult fractions and decimals?
Like how to comprehend them or a program that would teach them? Okay, yes. How do you have recommendations to deal with fractions and decimals? Okay. I tend to teach as a ratio, so I'm very heavy on proportional learning. So we deal with proportions. I even went, you know, I learned chemistry back when it was straight proportions. All you did was find the proportion. You didn't use a lot of formulas. And so I'm very heavy on that, and I teach them just the simple things like when you see the is and the of, you put the equation together that way. And therefore, they begin to see the fraction more mentally, and then they kind of ease into it. A specific program? I don't know a specific program that actually deals with the fractions and the proportions, but I do make up some of those worksheets which have the long written out word problems. Just many, 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 so that they learn where to put the three numbers and have the one missing number. And that has tended to be very, very helpful for us.
Have you ever caught yourself preparing for like a family vacation by thinking in terms, well, we're going here, so these would be the types of questions or things that I look for that deal with math? Do you do that, or has it become so natural that you just don't need to worry about that anymore?
I think the learning opportunities usually present themselves. You know, we do a lot of the climbing and the hiking and things like that on our trips. We don't tend to sit down with a pencil and paper and do a lot of math, but that is the inspiration, really. But we do, you know, star shows. We do some geology. All of that has math in it, and so we do get some of that. But some of the family vacations, you know, I have six children, three boys and then three girls. So most of family vacation is just finding your stuff. Is that about the way it is for you? Okay, so finding your stuff and getting it washed and getting people fed, mom is incredibly busy. This is one of the only vacations where I don't have any children with me. So,
how do you implement a dual curriculum? Because we started with Singapore, but it went too quickly into multiplication for my kids. And so then we went to Matthew C to get the basics really, so that they really had the basics down. So when you said dual curriculum, how do you actually implement that?
I would say probably just as you're doing, which is put a bookmark in the spot where you ended.
So don't throw away the Singapore books.
No. Keep it. Right, put a bookmark in it and then come back. And I frequently will tell my students, this Singapore math is more significant, you know, and they'll want to do it. They'll want to do the hard stuff. They'll want to get prepared in order to do it. Right. So whatever little fun activities they do. Now, there's just 1 minute left, so perhaps one question. Yes?
Do you have any, like, a CD or songs and stuff like that for kids to master timetables?
Oh, there are lots of products to master timetables. I'm going to go ahead and let the tape know. In order to master timetables, lots of songs and things like that that you can go ahead and purchase. I know we have a couple of tapes. I don't remember what the name is, or it just runs through the timetables. It's fairly simple to find on educational sites. So,
any recommendation? I've seen a lot. But
No, I don't have any particular recommendations. Some of the music I don't like. Kids tend to pick it up anyway. That, you know, they like it. So find a piece that your children can listen to. It's even better if you like it. Right. Okay, I think we're finished. Thank you very much.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.